Welcome everyone to this webinar brought to you by the McKinsey Institute USA, entitled Starting a Private Practice on a Shoestring Budget, From Concept to Grand Opening. This first webinar in a two-part series will take you from your initial idea of starting a private practice to opening your doors for business. I'm Jason Ward, and it's an honor for me to be asked to assist in bringing to you this content. Today we'll hear from our guests, a little background information to set the stage, some considerations that you should have before investing time, effort, and resources, a list of to-dos required before you start, what capital you should expect required, and the timeline required. And so let me first introduce our guests today. First, Kay Scanlon from Jenkintown in Phoenixville, Pennsylvania, and her clinic name is Kay Scanlon PT. Thanks for joining us, Kay.
Thanks. Good to be here, Jason.
And Jane Borgehammer of Synergy PT. She's in Westmont, Illinois. Jane, glad to have you with us as well.
Likewise. Thank you for having us.
So I'm excited to help out with this webinar for the McKinsey Institute USA. And first, I just want to give you ladies an opportunity to describe the backstory, your history a bit, that led you to opening a practice. So would you tell us a bit about your career, prior training, your work history, your experience, and then explain your practice? Kay, why don't you start us off?
Okay, be happy to. I actually grew up in Michigan and relocated to Pennsylvania to go to PT school. And so I'm kind of doing the shoestring practice, but in reverse. I met my first business partner on my first job, and we opened a practice in 1984. We had an industrial orthopedic practice, kind of an MDT focus, but we grew to two offices and had a work hardening center and 12 employees. And during that time, I pursued my orthopedic certification, my credentialing in McKinsey to kind of help build my skill set. But I really wanted more, so I spent some time observing some expert clinicians, Greg Silva, Russ Poole, John Barbas, and I really loved that model they had of one-on-one, small office, you know, minimal overhead. I just kind of kept that in the back of my mind and came to serve me years later. Anyway, I went on and did the diploma program and my transitional DPT, and after going through the diploma program with Todd, it really changed my habits completely. And in the meantime, my partner decided she wanted to move out of state, and I didn't really relish becoming a full-time manager. I really wanted to develop my clinical skills. So after 20 years of practice, we decided to sell. And at first, I was just going to use my newly gained expertise to help other practitioners learn more about MDT, and accepted a part-time faculty position in a PT program. But I kept doing clinical care as a contractor to further hone my skills. But in the clinic, it became evident that people were a lot more concerned about quantity than quality, and that really frustrated me. So I began to think about that model I'd seen years before: small, minimal equipment, low overhead. And about that same time, push came to shove, and I was told I wasn't billing enough, I weren't seeing patients enough visits. So in 6 short weeks, I decided to open my own shoestring practice. Now, let me tell you, that was stressful. But I wanted to see, could I realize that dream that I'd had in the past? So that's kind of what brought me up to that point.
Thank you, Kay. Jane, give us your story.
Sure. I'm from the Philippines, and this was supposed to be my 2-year gig before I went back home to study medicine. Well, that never happened. I moved here in 1995, worked as a contract PT wherever they basically had openings. They filled me in the hospital, outpatient, rehab. I think I did subacute and early intervention too. At some point, I ended up doing mainly outpatient. I believe that was from 2000 onwards, and discovered MDT, got hooked. Started my diploma program in 2008, ended up in Scotland. And in Scotland, it was amazing because all I had was two little plinths in the room, my partner and I, and that was all we had to use. We had a little gym that we never used. We had modalities and weights and steps and all those things, I'm sure somewhere else, but we never used that. And I started thinking, wow, this is pretty impressive. This is pretty amazing because you had nothing else but your patience and your imagination and creativity to get their program running. So when I came back, the place that I really wanted to work at, and I still work for them one day a week, was an hour away. And my husband said, you've got to be able to have more flexibility. I have children. So at some point I broke free and, like Kay, decided that instead of looking at units billed, I wanted to look at outcomes more. And my crazy husband supported me, and here I am 3 years later with my own practice.
Wow, great. Quite a different story in terms of the background, but you're both in a similar place now. So thanks for sharing that with us. I want to give you an opportunity also to let's get to the what and the where, but let's do it first by starting with the why. Would you let us in on your primary struggles and what left you unfulfilled that stimulated your interest in doing what you've done? Jane, why don't you start us off on the why?
Sure. When I look back on where I came from, it's a third world country, and you always got paid for your results, meaning if you were not a good clinician, your practice didn't thrive. When I got here, our practice is very different. You got measured by the amount of units you build. And I always looked at it, and I think we went into this practice because of the patients. We're spending more and more as a country and not necessarily seeing better results. So I figured this is not going to last forever. We are going to be held accountable for what we do in the practice. And this fee-for-service model won't hold up. I mean, it's already being questioned. So I thought, let's get ahead of the curve and focus on the patients again, focus on the value of our care.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great. And Kay, what about you?
I agree with Jane. I think that was my frustration as well. And I see the models that APTA is going towards as far as reimbursement, looking at intensity and severity, and it fits the MDT model perfectly. You know, we're going to come out on top as long as we have enough clinicians that can use the skills appropriately and apply them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very good. Jane and Kay, knowing what you know now, what does it take to own your own practice? Is it for everyone? And if it's not, what are those serious red flags that you might see looking back now that a person should consider if they're kind of on the fence of, do I do this or not? Let's go with Kay, why don't you talk to us?
Okay. Well, I guess the first thing is guts.
Yeah.
You have to have a fair amount of guts to even take the chance. You know, many businesses fail right off the bat. Optimism, I mean, you've got to be a kind of person that sees the glass half full. And determination, you've really got to be willing to not give up every time, you know, the visits dive and you think, oh my goodness, am I falling apart here? Mm-hmm. I think another thing is really good clinical skills, especially if you have a niche area like MDT. Mm-hmm. And lastly, I would say you've got to have a willingness to wear many hats. You've got to act as the manager, the marketer, the office manager, the bookkeeper, and the clinician, kind of all rolled into one, that true entrepreneurial spirit. And having a supportive spouse or significant other certainly doesn't hurt either.
Mm-hmm. Jane, anything you'd add to that, or what would you really emphasize?
No, I agree 100% with what Kay said. When you're an employee, you only answer to your direct supervisor or your boss. When you're your own boss, you answer to whoever comes your way, whether that's the patients, whether that's looking at it from billing, whether that's looking at it from you're now the marketer and you have to deal with your community and referral sources. We all know that most of these businesses actually fail within 4 to 5 years, the first 4 to 5 years, regardless of the background. So you've got to really want to succeed. And I looked at it and I thought, when you regret not trying it more than you fear the failure, then that's the bottom line. You will do whatever you need to succeed in your clinic. Thinking about the overhead, I believe is a big deal. We underestimate how much it will cost. We underestimate that we have to pay all the taxes, the rent, the maintenance. It's not a lot when you do a shoestring budget, but it's still something to keep in mind.
Yeah. Kay, you mentioned a moment ago about a bookkeeper, an accountant, those type of things. I'm envisioning someone out there who thinks, you know what, I've done our taxes for our home before, and I take care of our checkbook and make sure everything is accounted for. Could they possibly do well and be able to manage the clinic books if they have that affinity in their background?
Well, I think if you haven't done business bookkeeping before, it's a whole different animal. You really need to meet with an accountant and have them help you set things up. You can probably use a program such as Quicken or something like that, but you need to have it set up appropriately and know what categories to put things in and so forth so that you can get some help with that.
Right, right. Okay. Let's move into the early planning then. Will you think back to the beginning and let's walk through those first several steps you took to lay the groundwork. Give us a list of the to-dos you tackled first. Kay, go ahead.
All righty. Well, unlike Jane, I had direct access certificate for some years in the state, which allows us to treat patients for 30 days. So I knew that was going to be a big help for me to market directly to the public. Also, meeting with an accountant to make sure that I had my books set up correctly. If you've done them at home before, having a business account is very, very different. You need to make sure you have the assets and liabilities, and using a program such as Quicken can be very helpful in setting that up, but you really need to meet with an accountant, probably an attorney as well. Setting up a business bank account is crucial, so you're keeping your funds from the business separate from your personal monies. And for me, since I had such a short period of time, 6 weeks, finding space was crucial. I had to do that right up front, and then making sure I had professional and general liability in force, because you don't want to open your doors without making sure you've got both of those.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of my early thinking. Of course, only 6 weeks. It was all early.
That's right. Good point. Jane, tell us your take on this.
Mine was a little bit longer, I guess, in terms of planning. I had seriously been thinking about my own practice over the course of about 2 to 3 years. So I had the time to talk to accountants over and over again. I talked to a lawyer. I talked to the Small Business Administration, which has a mentoring arm called SCORE. And they basically are a bunch of successful businessmen that have nothing else to do but mentor you and talk you through the planning phases, the implementation phases, and you can use them as a resource later on. I talked to as many business owners as I could, even if they weren't in healthcare, because I figured the business concepts and practices, many of them have common threads regardless of your background. Know your practice act. Here in Illinois, all I have is direct access for the evaluation and nothing else. So keep that in mind when you're figuring out your business model. The accountant was very helpful because we went over the pros and cons of incorporating versus not incorporating. And if you do incorporate, we went over the pros and cons of LLC versus S corporation or professional corporation. Those were things I had no clue, no idea about until I started asking the questions. As for the attorney, he informed me that regardless of how I incorporated, it didn't really matter, because if you did something wrong, they will go after your assets regardless. So do the right thing, follow your state act, follow the federal act, and have really good business and general liability. Hopefully you'll never ever need that, but you need to have the malpractice insurance.
Right, got to have that protection there. All right, once you've gotten that initial list checked off, and of course I know, Kay, everything was kind of probably washed together, but what was next on the list in terms of setting up the clinic possibly? Talk to us about that, Kay.
Okay. Well, contacting my existing patients, letting them know I was going to be going out on my own. Since I was a contractor, I didn't really have a non-compete clause, so they were able to follow me if they wanted to. Contacting my referral sources, friends, any professional contacts, let them know I was opening my own doors. The other thing I decided was I would accept Medicare. I thought that would kind of help balance out the cash side of the practice. So right away I started enrolling with Medicare, because that does take a little time to get that set up. they have to come out and do an on-site inspection, and it just takes a while to get your provider number, which is different than if you've been working in a practice with your NPI. It's a different number. Also, I chose to opt out of commercial insurances because they would continue to keep me on as a participating provider if I didn't do that. So in the practice I'd been in, there were a lot of commercial insurances I needed to opt out of. And then it was really gathering the equipment I needed, getting the clinic and the office set up, making sure I had all the tools I needed to open the doors. Mm-hmm. That's pretty much that next step.
Mm-hmm. Jane, what pops in your mind is what came along to you next?
Okay, so as Kay said, you need your NPI, both business and individual. You need to figure out your business name. Once you have those, you can get incorporated and start your business account. Kay did it a little bit different because it's under her name, but as an incorporated entity, I needed to get these legalities out of the way and then start heading down the track. The next most important part is your lease. Figure out where you're going to be. Ask all the questions about what's included in the lease. Do you pay for it, or is it included in your monthly dues? Once you have that, at least you have the overhead costs more under control and you have an idea of what's needed in your physical clinic. I am actually subleasing, so my overhead is not as crazy. That was an option for me, luckily at that time. But my next step is actually to possibly look into clinic number two within the next year or two.
You know, you mentioned contacting the existing patients, and of course, we need to consider whether or not we have the ability to do that. You said you had no non-compete clause, Kay, is that right?
Correct.
And
correct.
Jane, were you the same?
No, mine was very different. For I was working for two places. My husband was still an employee at the time, so I had to be very careful to make sure that I kept that very much above board and didn't contact any patients just because he was employed there. The other place that I was employed at is a hospital, and they are not for profit, but they're very, very clear about what you do within their facility as an employee versus outside. So I basically had to start with nothing but friends. My first patient that actually came in was an old friend of mine that had encouraged me to start my own business probably for the last 3 years before I even opened my doors. So he was the one who came in and said, I will be your patient number one. And he literally was. As Kay said, though, at that point, you start from zero. You have nothing to lose and everything to gain. So you talk to as many people as you can, whether that's the health club, whether that's the community, whether that's the soccer parents on my kids' team, anyone who was willing to listen to me, I went for. My one patient that was really, really encouraging, too, told me that when he did his first lecture, he had space for, I think, 50 people. So he invited 50 people, ended up with three. The next lecture he did, he said, I had space for 50 people. I invited 500 people and ended up with 50. So I think that puts things into perspective. That's how many people you're going to have to contact, because they literally aren't your patient or your client till they walk through the door. Mm-hmm. Once they're in, your MDT training or your clinical skills and know-how, you'll get to keep them, but you've got to get them in your door one way, shape, or form.
Mm-hmm. And then finally, let's talk about those last few days, those hectic times right before you have a launch date, of Monday morning. What were you doing those days leading up to, and or a week or two for you, Jane?
Praying like crazy, Jason, that you didn't make the wrong mistake. That's literally it. Kay, I'll let you go first on this one.
Okay. Well, we spent the weekend before moving my Repex table from one room, one floor in the building to the other, and trying to get it on the elevator, and that was a real circus.
Wow.
But really, just spent those few days just getting everything set up. I actually sublet space in another person's office, so I just had one small room. So small little desk, my Repex table, and a stool. That was basically it. But getting all the procedure set up, how you're going to do scheduling, how you're going to handle the paperwork and the charts, how you're going to take collections or payment from patients. So getting that so you knew how it was going to flow before you opened the door was a big priority.
Mm-hmm. Let me just ask, you said subletting space. Where did you go? Where did you find that? How would you suggest someone might at least consider places that they could go to look for spaces?
Sure. I was in a professional building. It's a huge building already. And I thought, let me start here. This is where my patients are. This is my community. I know people in this area. So I just went to the rental office and started asking. And they showed me space that was way too big and then something that was way too small. And I said, gee, don't you have something else? Well, we know someone wants to sublet. And so that just was the perfect situation. I actually sublet space from an acupuncturist, and we shared the waiting room, and then I had my own dedicated treatment room. Mm-hmm. So for me, it was staying where my patients already were and the community that I was in and in a professional building that was well-known.
And remind us of the size of the space that you had starting out?
The first space was, gosh, maybe not even 200 square feet. Okay. It's really small. I could barely get at the end to do traction, retraction, extension with a cervical patient.
Okay. You had to limit your patients from 6'5 and down.
Exactly.
All right. And then, Jane, talk to us about those last few days leading up to your launch date.
Mine was probably a little less stressful than Kay because I was moving into an existing practice. The chiropractor that I'm subleasing from, he decided to go from a 5-employee or 5-clinician practice to a straight cash practice. And he didn't want any employees, and he had lost his physical therapist. So what ended up happening was it was him, one chiropractor, another one, and me, all subleasing and sharing the space of about 2,400 square feet. So we have a shared reception or waiting area, a shared gym, but my actual treatment area is more similar to Kay's. It's just a little room. It's a private room. It has a treatment plinth. It has a little spot where I can put my treat your own back books, a chair for the patient, a stool for me, and that's it. It's bare bones. We actually will try putting some pictures of the clinic up through MIUSA so that people can get an idea and direct the conversation towards LinkedIn so we can keep asking questions and talking about it back and forth there.
And then talk to me about electronic system versus paper charts. How did you ladies start those things out? Jane, you want to start first?
Sure. I started out actually with paper charts and just use our McKenzie evaluation forms for whatever body part came my way. Most of the patients that were coming to see me are musculoskeletal or chronic pain. I would get the occasional person who said, Jane, can you see someone for gait? But it's few and far between. About 6 months into the practice, I had heard about Practice Fusion, which is an electronic medical record system, but I could do scheduling on it. And more importantly, as a parent, I could do my documentation either in the clinic on site or I could do it at home. So that worked out for my purposes. Plus, the overhead was really nothing. And I transitioned over to that, and I'd be perfectly happy with it. You can make your own template. You can send faxes. You can send referral reports and all those things through the one system. So that's how I transitioned over.
And through that transition on the back end now, you look back and see that as a valuable and a way to help in terms of time effectiveness or efficiency?
It does, because that means I'm not tied physically to the clinic, and it follows all the rules for patient privacy, and I can log in and log out. Keep records secure is a big thing, regardless of where I'm at.
Mm-hmm. And then Kay, talk to us about what you chose to do initially and then maybe what you've converted toward, if you've converted.
Well, I had used several EMR systems in the clinics previously and thought, boy, that's how I need to go. This is the future and this is going to be the best thing. And I started out with a pretty complicated EMR system. And after about 4 weeks, I said, this is crazy. I don't need all this information for majority cash practice. Mm-hmm. So I actually decided to go back the opposite way and went back to pen and paper.
Yeah.
And I use a template and I use the McKenzie forms, and I've just got it set up that way, and it's working really, really well. Mm-hmm. Although I may look at Practice Fusion.
And then in terms of using those paper charts and using a template, I assume what you're saying then is that you plug in your entries, and then you print that off and fax that to your physicians or your referral sources?
Exactly. And I didn't have a fax machine starting out, so I used e-fax, which is fantastic. You can just attach a document and it goes as if it were a fax, and they come back to you as if it were a fax, but it goes through your email. So that works really, really smoothly for me with those templates.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's get to the some of the bigger questions that I think that might be out there. You've led us right up to the opening day. Let's talk money for a moment. What kind of capital are we talking about up to this point, and maybe give us a range from bare bones to upper end? Kay, your thoughts.
And I really had started with quite a small amount, probably $2,000 to $3,000, because I really had most all of my equipment. I think I purchased a computer and a printer. Everything else I pretty much had. Mm-hmm. So I just had to have that first and last month's rent, my security deposit, and anything small I needed as far as bookkeeping things and charts and so forth.
Talk to us, though, if you look back and you consider what did I have to have in that office that I already had, any ideas as to what that would have taken you up to if you had to purchase that?
Well, the Repex is pretty expensive.
Right.
But you certainly could start with just a treatment table. Yeah, probably $4,000 to $5,000.
Yeah.
Yep.
All right. Jane, your thoughts. Tell us about your experience.
I started without patients, so I figured at least 3 months of your overhead, plus your equipment. So I probably would shift my number up to about $10,000 to $12,000 is what I started with. And it was just because I had no income from day one. Plus, mine was not a straightforward cash practice. Mine was I billed Medicare and I billed Blue Cross Blue Shield, and everyone else was out of network. As Kay mentioned, once you enroll, you don't get that cash flow. You have to get accepted. You have to get the accreditation. That takes several months for both Medicare and Blue Cross Blue Shield. So I knew I was not going to have any income for the first 2 to 3 months, which is what ended up happening. Just budget for that. Account for the fact that after your equipment, you've still got the ongoing costs of rent, utilities, and whatever your monthly association dues are. And at least you'll have a more realistic picture and not panic by the time you get to day 45 of opening your clinic.
Mm-hmm. All right. For the clinician out there who's working for the man or the woman, but who is internally unsettled or feeling the desire to break out on their own, what kind of timeline should they consider? You both have mentioned a bit about your timeline, but talk to us a bit about that. Jane, you want to start?
Sure. I think figure out your business model first. There are so many websites that you could look at, Fair Health or fairconsumers.org. Many of them are not for profit, but it gives you an idea. And even the Medicare website, the CMS website, it tells you how much you get reimbursed based on your zip code, based on your setting. Once you look into that, you know what your income will be like. Because I think when we bill as an employee, we think, oh, that looks good. I can certainly live off that, not knowing that the tail end or what you actually get reimbursed is a very different number.
Okay, what do you have to say about that?
Well, I certainly don't recommend doing it in 6 weeks. That was pretty stressful. I would get at least 6 months, probably closer to 12 months is more appropriate. If you've had any business experience in the past, that will certainly come to help you, but there's a huge learning curve if you haven't done that. And I already had a lot of things in place, so for me it was a lot easier. I had prior business knowledge. I had some legal and accounting relationships and things set up. I had some equipment already. I had a patient referral base. A lot of the forms that I'd used previously in my practice, like the HIPAA form, my authorization form, all those things I had in place, so that made it a lot easier to get started.
Mm-hmm. 6 months, then both of you are kind of saying,
right? Minimum,
yeah.
Plus 30%, right? Is that what they say, to add about 30% to?
Yeah.
Yes.
Right.
3 months, 30%. There you go.
One thing I just wanted to mention that Jane said about Medicare that folks may not know is that if you're applying for a Medicare number, which you want to do that right away, you can certainly hold the bills. So maybe you're waiting a couple weeks to get that approval number. You could hold the bills and submit them once you have it, as long as you think you're going to pass their inspection.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. All right, for a minute, if we reflect back on what we just outlined, understanding that there are plenty of private practice consultant firms out there who are definitely willing to walk someone through opening a traditional or mainstream clinic or eclectic practice, what would differ in your ladies' minds in planning and preparing for opening of a private practice on a shoestring budget for a clinician committed to adhering to MDT principles as opposed to those opening a mainstream or traditional PT clinic? Kay, start us off there.
Oh my goodness, big difference. I guess the big one is it's a lot less time and financial resources to open a shoestring MDT clinic. You're not trying to hire employees. You don't have a huge amount of space or a lot of equipment that you have to get in place. So that's just so much easier. I think the other important thing is you really need strong clinical skills going into this. You want to be looked at as the expert in MDT, and not try to be a jack of all trades, because they're going to need bicycles and treadmills and all kinds of various equipment if they're going to do gait analysis and all of that. If you're just trying to hone in on MDT, you don't need a lot, as we've really talked about.
Mm-hmm. Jane, your thoughts on that?
Yes, if you approach it from the conventional approach and having someone help you out and get a franchise, they're looking at you as a venture capitalist. So as a clinician or a business owner, you don't have a lot of initial outlay with capital and with resources. However, your return on your investment is also going to be the same. They will expect you to be billing a lot to make it worth their while to invest in you, so to speak. If you go the flip side and say, I have a shoestring clinic, bare bones, basic clinic, boiling it down to what you really need, your potential for growth is so much higher because you don't have to cover the cost of your expensive equipment. Your patients long-term will help you drive that business growth. It's short-term, you're not going to get a lot, but long-term, over the course of 6 months, over the course of 1 year, year by year, I've seen my business grow. The smallest has been 30%. Of course, I'm starting from zero is what you could say. But within the span of 3 years, I've been able to make more as a self-employed business owner than I would have if I was employed as an employee. So there's definitely potential for growth, but you have to be honest to yourself. You have to be honest to the patient and let your results drive your growth.
Mm-hmm. And as with a lot of things, would you ladies agree that this is more of a marathon than a sprint?
Definitely. Oh,
most definitely. And Jason, I wanted to add something here too. When I was teaching in a PT program, the students would have to do projects and, you know, come up with that typical business model that we all worked with when we were in school. And many of them are looking at tens of thousands of dollars worth of equipment and large space to make it flashy. And the debt you're going to go into to do that, if you did it on your own without a franchise, it's going to take you years and years and years to recoup. Mm-hmm. So, again, like you said, this is definitely a marathon, not the sprint, but at least you don't need to go buy the most expensive running shoes to start out.
Yeah, that's a great point, and I think a lot of times we don't realize the strains that puts on a clinician trying to own their own business when they get themselves in debt. That's definitely a challenge. Mm-hmm. All right, I'd love to hear from you ladies a few major mistakes that you made early on. I think I hear from you, Kay, a resounding, don't squeeze this in within a 6 week period of time. But look back at the time frame that you did have and consider what was the one or two things that you saw that you did that you do differently now. Jane, why don't you start us?
I probably would have gotten into this sooner.
Ah, great point.
So when I first started coming up with my business model and business concept, I really thought of it more in terms of the traditional. You have an employee doing your billing, you have a receptionist, and you really don't need all of that. With the advent of electronic medical records and the patient's ability to schedule and your ability to manage your practice, whether you're physically in the clinic or elsewhere, and still keep patient privacy, patient records secure, there's so much more flexibility now than there probably was 10 years ago. One of the big things I wished I would have done, as I said, is start earlier, because I have a lot more flexibility with my family, with hours. I can leave for 2 hours and go right back. As an employee, I could never have done that. I'm trying to think of what else. Kay, what else do you have to add?
Yeah, I know. I was trying to think of that, too. I guess, for me, everything kind of lined up to have this happen. It kind of pushed me into this direction. Even though I'd been thinking about it for a long time, the timing just wasn't right because we had the large practice, and then I wanted to try some teaching for a while. So it just the timing was just right for me to do this. But I guess I regret trying the AMAR program. I think that just made things more complex for me starting out. You could always move to that later if you felt the need. I think another mistake was really trying to do this in 6 weeks. It was very, very stressful. I felt some nights I was going to have a heart attack when I came home.
Right.
The other thing that would have been really helpful had I done in the very beginning, even though you're busy trying to get things up and running, but to get out there in the community and do a lot more speaking engagements. So you're really getting to the community that is searching so much for something that we have to offer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we'll definitely get into that in the next phase of talking about starting this shoestring practice. Jane and Kay, I would like to hear, if you just boil it down now for us, what's the greatest advice you'd give for the MDT clinician considering opening a private practice and needing to do so on a shoestring budget? Jane, what are your thoughts?
I think the ultimate goal is to make an honest living and not a killing. So thinking of it as billing for what the patient actually needs, taking them from healthcare to self-care, you will get the patient loyalty long-term. They will tell people about you. You don't have to bill them 3 times a week for 6 weeks, which would never get reimbursed in today's environment anyway. And at the end of the day, it's how much you keep that really matters. So whether that's smaller overhead means you don't have to pay for that versus big overhead, but you still have to cover the cost. That's what I looked at when I'm thinking shoestring budget, bare bones, basic patient skills is what you need.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Kay, what do you have to add?
I probably have 3 things that I came up with here at Be the Best Advice. And I think number one, what really helped me is to visit an expert clinician, hopefully a diplomat, in their clinical practice and really observe what they do. Unless you've been through the diploma program and you have that knowledge already, otherwise it's really going to change the way you look at practice and the way you would look at setting up a clinic. The second thing I think is to seek a mentor who's really going to give you honest, straightforward advice along the way. I've had many mentors in different areas that have really been so helpful to me in kind of boiling things down. And then the last thing, I know we don't want to start this big practice like we're talking about, but if you don't have any knowledge of billing or how to set up the books or how to look at a contract or a lease, you might want to consider taking a course on that. And the private practice section has one talking about how to start a private practice. Now, a lot of that are going to be things that you may not use as this small niche practice, but if you don't have that prior business knowledge, it'll get you up and running with that information pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. Great points. A special thanks to both of you for sharing your experience and your thoughts on starting a private practice on a shoestring budget. Any final thoughts, or is that pretty well wrap it up?
Just do it.
There you go.
Exactly. Go for it.
All right. I trust you've appreciated Jane and Kay's story, their insights and what it takes to be successful, some to-dos in the early and late stages, and the resources that have been mentioned pertaining to those tasks. Also, a ballpark dollar figure you might need and a general timeline you should expect. I also hope you picked up on the fact that less is needed in starting a private practice built around MDT, especially when you compare to a traditional PT clinic, and that a bare-bones MDT clinic is well-equipped to handle the typical outpatient orthopedic physical therapy patient clientele. Be looking for the second webinar, which we'll cover from launch through a well-established brand. And thanks again for joining us today.